Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. A new Quinnipiac poll shows the race for governor is too close to call. Of course, we have several months before that the fateful day of the vote. But in the meantime, former Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Director Richard Cordray is 2 percentage points ahead of State Attorney General Mike DeWine. That makes it a statistical dead heat. Joining us to talk about that and more is Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Andy, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
And Associated Press reporter Julie Carr-Smythe. Welcome back, Julie.
Good morning.
And Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's a statistical dead heat. Quinnipiac is kind of the gold standard these days. How much do you trust it, Julie Carr-Smythe?
You know, in post-2016 America, I'm really hedging my bets on any poll, only for the reason that they certainly failed us last time. Mm-hmm. I feel as if Americans are a little skeptical. Could they be not telling the truth? Or have they not made up their mind, that kind of thing. But it is the gold standard. And for what we have available, it's pretty interesting, given this is what Democrats would have predicted. They really wanted Cordray to win the primary because they felt that he was going to be strong. He's brought in people like Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden to campaign for him, and that resonates with Democrats.
Yeah, and I think that, if you were to look at it from this standpoint, Mike DeWine has been the AG for 7 years. He's been in Ohio, making news in Ohio for 7 years, basically building up a name for himself.
Yeah, he's very much of a news machine.
Yeah, whereas Cordray just kind of popped back into the public eye last year, after taking a long time off, not being in the public eye in Ohio. So the fact that he's already doing so well in this one-on-one matchup might bode well for the Democrats.
Mm. Well, I give the poll a little more credence, I think, because I look back to the 2010 Attorney General's mm-hmm. race when DeWine faced Cordray and won by 1 percentage point. So I think, you know, given the political landscape this year, their past history, you know, in races together, I expect this to be a tight race that'll just keep getting tighter. You know, both of these candidates just came out of primaries. DeWine's was particularly brutal, I think, compared to Cordray's. Mm-hmm. The Democrats are more lined up behind him, perhaps, than the Republicans are behind DeWine at this point, but it's still early and there's certainly a lot of undecideds. But you might have seen a little lack of enthusiasm for DeWine among some parts of the Republicans. That may have responded to that poll.
Coming out of the primary.
Which is, you're always going to have that marginal number in a rough
sure.
primary like that. It was pretty vitriolic. But I also give Cordray a little more credit to the kind of publicity that he did get as head of the Consumer Protection and Finance Bureau. I mean, I think that there was a lot of publicity on that, a lot more than you might ordinarily expect
right.
from someone in that position.
And I do think that if you're following national politics, which certainly we hope many Ohioans are.
We like to think you are.
They are.
How can you not? I mean, how can you not?
Yeah. Right.
Somebody explain that to me because I'd like to know how to turn it off.
Watch an accident.
Is there a screen anywhere around you?
But, you know, you would have seen the whole debate. You would have seen Trump, you know, kind of throw or Cordray leave, but, you know, him throw in a rival to Cordray into mm-hmm. that job. Cordray has tried to keep that high profile by explaining what he did with the agency and how he then how Mulvaney is trying to, you know, kind of stamp it all out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really good point. And as well as that is that what we saw in the spending reports on Friday is what Cordray wound up spending. It was all positive, build your name ID type advertising. Mm-hmm. He really didn't have to run too much negative at all. Mm-hmm. He comes out of this
using the same thing, and you know, yeah.
And he comes out of this with Joe Schiavone up in Youngstown having really mobilized the Mahoning Valley, which went Trump mm-hmm. last time
mm-hmm.
for Democrats. So Schiavone got a lot of those folks re-registered, and it's just an interesting landscape for them compared to, as Kathy says, DeWine having had to really fight a nasty battle.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, also with us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. Andy?
I was going to say, Ann, you're right that Cordray did get a lot of publicity, or his bureau, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, got a lot of publicity when they were doing things like cracking down on Wells Fargo and payday lending issues. So I think the goal now for Democrats is to corral the existing public knowledge that people have on those issues and point it to Cordray and say, hey, you know, all those things where government was taking on corruption. Well, this is the guy who did it. So I think that's one of the big challenges that they have in front of them right now. And because of the current political climate in Ohio, where there are certain scandals and possible cases of corruption happening, it could be to their benefit because of his past experience with that bureau.
And I also think that as a veteran office holder, Mike DeWine has more baggage than some others. And certainly there are some questions around his advice to former Speaker Cliff Rosenberger to please step aside, if he had done something wrong. The question is sort of why he made that interjection
why
into that
involved.
Situation.
Yeah.
Right. And then now a lot is going on there as far as the FBI is looking at Rosenberger, and Democrats most certainly are going to try to use that to paint the entire Republican Party. Then, of course, you have Trump. And so you add all that together for a Republican candidate this year in a swing state. And even without a Democratic wave, could it possibly be tighter even than expected?
You see, Democrats win. I mean, we just had a Democratic governor one governor ago, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
One term ago. It's not unusual for our state to swing in these executive offices, governor and auditor, AG and stuff like that. So I expect it's just going to be a really close race, and we'll see whose base turns out.
The thing I wonder is where does DeWine take his fight from here? Because I think the thing that he's struggled with for a lot of his career, especially near the end of his run as a senator, is that there are people who called him Republican in name only, thinking that he wasn't conservative enough. Now, I think through his time as AG, through his support of people like President Trump, and when Jeff Sessions was running when he was up for attorney, U.S. Attorney General, he was right behind him during that testimony. So now he may have painted himself almost too far into that corner, into sort of the Trump camp, where he doesn't appeal to He might not appeal to conservatives who have known him for so long that they just have this idea that he's Republican in name only.
And
he may have
turn off moderate Democrats.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And so I wonder what his game plan is from here, and how does he corral the support that he needs to overcome somebody like Cordray, who has proven in the past that he does have a lot of mainstream appeal.
And we can't forget the Kasich factor. This
right.
poll was fascinating on
yes.
Kasich. Who I don't have it in front of me, but he had more support from Democrats, I think, than Republicans. Still very popular. And Cordray came right out of the box, if you recall. Kasich had said, I don't know whether I'm going to endorse Mike DeWine. What I care about is Medicaid expansion. And what was the second one? There were two. And Jobs Ohio, the
Jobs
future
Ohio.
Of Jobs Ohio. So he comes out of the box saying that. And Cordray went right up on TV and said, listen, I'm your guy. If you like John Kasich, I'm for extending Jobs Ohio. I'm for Medicaid expansion. And, you know, now where do they go from there? Because for all.
And they don't have the guns. I mean, NRA's kind of not a player in this because
nobody wants to tout that as.
Right.
And also they're both supported by NRA, so
right.
where do you go from
well,
there?
Well, I think Cordray more than DeWine. I might be wrong about that.
Well, when they last ran against each other, I believe the NRA favored Cordray's positions on guns more than DeWine's. Things have changed, and I think DeWine was supported on his next go-around when he re-ran for attorney general. So.
What about money? How are they going to stack up when it comes to the Buccarinos? Yeah.
Well, I looked at the reports Friday. Mike DeWine is loaded, absolutely loaded. He has something like 7 million. Yes. And I did look back. He brought forward about 3.5 million from the past. So that's part of it. The fundraising numbers weren't particularly different. They were off by about maybe DeWine this period made $1 million more than Cordray. So that wasn't as far off as the bank, what they have in the bank, which is he's way ahead.
But do you have any doubt that, Cordray will get the funding he needs? I mean, this is a nationally watched race. The Democrats will come through with
money. It's in a dead heat now. There's something to work with there.
And
DeWine may be ahead at the moment.
It's
but
irrelevant.
It's kind of irrelevant. Yeah.
Right, because they had said the Democratic Party itself didn't even get involved in the primary. They didn't endorse, and everybody was going to wait for the winner.
And we've talked in the past about these statewide races where there's a lot of outside money coming in. When Portman ran against Strickland for his reelection in the Senate, we talked about how there was a lot of dark money and outside money coming in, third-party money. Same when Josh Mandel ran against Sherrod Brown. I think the interesting thing here is we might see the Democrat candidate maybe get a lot of that outside money, get a lot of outside support through campaign machines like Elizabeth Warren,
Joe Biden,
Barack Obama. They might mobilize and get a lot of people to jump into this
Who
race.
Who do you think's the best person that Richard Cordray could bring to the fore? What's the big get? Is it Barack Obama? Is it Elizabeth Warren? Is very
she's kind of a lightning rod.
Yeah, right.
I think if Joe Obama Biden? Comes out for him, Joe Biden obviously mobilizes the blue collar.
He doesn't bug anybody. Yeah,
and people just love him on the left as far as the labor groups and things. That's the same group though that Cordray has by having Betty Sutton on his ticket. So I feel like if he can get Obama, Obama is still very popular among Ohioans, I would guess.
And he gets better. He gets better the longer he's out of office, like most presidents do.
Yeah.
You know, the longer he's out, the better. But Obama and Biden together, can you see them making a joint appearance in Ohio for Cordray? That'd be pretty something.
And it would do something to maybe squash the reputation Cordray has as being not that exciting. And so if you have President Obama there, that becomes more of a show and can actually generate some excitement.
Right. And this is our first cycle without John Glenn, who always was a help to any Democrat. And so, you know, you certainly don't want to bring a Clinton into it. You know,
This may be the first time we don't see a Clinton come, right?
Ohioans
love Bill Clinton.
And on the flip end, I mean, as soon as Mike DeWine won the Republican nomination, won the primary, I think he was quickly put into a tough spot. And everybody said, what are you going to do as far as endorsements? If President Donald Trump wanted to come in, would you campaign with him? Also, if this popular Governor John Kasich wanted to campaign with you, would you allow him? And he said, oh, I would want anybody to campaign with me. But that's not close to reality.
When Donald Trump was here, Mike DeWine was busy.
Right. For the past few times.
Pence obviously was just here on
did
Friday.
Did he appear with Pence? I don't know. Did he?
He did? Okay.
Yes, I thought that maybe that was Troy Balderson.
I thought it was Troy Balderson with the 12th District race, which we will be talking about. It is our weekly reporters roundtable. It's politics, politics, politics with Julie Carr-Smythe. It's so exciting. Julie Carr-Smythe, State House correspondent and reporter for the Associated Press. Kathy Kandisky, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. And Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. We're talking politics. Julie Carr-Smyth, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. They're all with me. We've been talking about that dead heat in the gubernatorial race right now between Democrat Richard Cordray and Republican Mike DeWine. We can't, you know, there's another one that matters as well. That's the 12th district race for Congress to replace the early retirement of Pat Tiberi. We have running for that Troy Balderson on the Republican side and Danny O'Connor on the Democratic side. This is important. People are watching it. A story in the Dispatch today compared it to that race in 180 miles away or something like that in Pennsylvania as something of a bellwether type of thing about this blue wave. But what do you think, Kathy Kandisky?
Well, I think the last poll that came out on this showed that Balderson was, I think, 10 points ahead. So it looks like he's got a good lead. I mean, this is a solid Republican district.
Right.
This has been a Republican-leaning
district. It was Kasich's
district
before Tiberi.
Kasich, Tiberi. I mean, there hasn't been a Democrat in this district since, was it Schimansky?
Yeah.
Like in the 70s or
but
something?
But it's also a very suburban district, and that's where you might find some turnaround.
And there are some rural areas in it, too. I think the Democrats fought hard for the areas of, is it Licking County and out toward Zanesville?
Well, Zanesville, that's where Balderson's from,
too. Right, right.
But I think, you know, Jessica Werman had a story for us in the paper today about this race, and she pointed out very, you know, and I agree with this 100%, is watch to see who the parties send in and how much money they send
that
in.
That kind of inspired my line of questioning earlier on
did
the program.
It?
Is how much does it matter? Who will they send in?
I mean,
in?
They've got polling that shows if they think it's close, they're going to flood it with money and support, and you haven't seen that happen yet. It's going to be tough. It's an August election. I mean, how many people are going to go vote? It's going to be tough.
And these are people who, I mean, the people who live in the 12th district are people who, you know, take voting very seriously. People in Delaware County that seem to be very in tune with politics. And it usually tends to be that if those are the people who will go and vote for a special election, and those voters seem to be more Republican.
And then they'll be running again in November.
Yeehaw, we can do it all over.
I mean, it's just crazy.
It never ends. Yeah.
But I do think that there's also been a comfort level for people in that district. You go in every year. You cast your ballot for Pat Tiberi. He's been in there 18 years. You cast your ballot 18 years before that for Kasich.
Both suburban,
and they are going
Republicans,
to have to bring themselves up to speed on who these candidates are and what they stand for. I know that Melanie Lenihan, who was a primary candidate against Balderson, asked for a recount in at least one of the counties.
Is that going through? Is that
I haven't.
Underway?
I'm not up to speed on that, but I just know that she's very conservative and had a lot of national support. So that brought these divisions in that we were talking about earlier in the program into the Republican side of that may have some people inclined to come to the polls on an August day when they could be at the pool. You know, it's a tough one because
her supporters may not be enthused.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned that Pennsylvania race, and I'm remembering back to when that race ended. You and I were doing an event together, and you had mentioned that the Pennsylvania district has more registered Democratic voters than whereas the 12th district has more registered Republican voters.
Right.
And I think so it might look similar as far as population and demographics, but this has been a strongly held Republican district for a while with a lot of registered Republicans.
And it should be said, too, that the Democratic primary was also pretty tough. There were many, many candidates. Franklin County endorsed in the race. They endorsed O'Connor, which ticked off certain areas of the party that were fighting for that nomination. So it also was not, you know, just a smooth ride for Danny O'Connor.
Danny O'Connor's got the best shot in Franklin County. He's a Franklin County auditor or recorder, I forget.
Recorder.
He's got the best shot of winning big in Franklin County, which to win in that race, you're going to have to, the Democrat would have to take it big. in the in Franklin County. So that may be the best shot they have. Important also to note that T-Berry is endorsing Balderson. That's his candidate. So mm-hmm. those people that have been happy with T-Berry all these years may need to know nothing more than that.
That he gets the endorsement. Yeah.
And I also think this would be a different game if it were Melanie Lenihan, somebody who is further to the right, maybe somebody who could be painted more as the Trump Republican, whereas Balderson has been known to be moderate most of the time. He does appeal to the further right on several issues. In his ads, he says that he's going to build Trump's wall. So, I mean, he's not afraid of embracing some of those issues. But because he is somebody who does seem to be able to appeal to the middle, he's not as easy of a target in that way.
And he's well known in his legislative district. I mean, he's the guy who pushed through the exotic animal yeah. legislation that was so, you know, mm-hmm. a high profile after the Lions, Tigers, and Bears escaped in Zanesville.
Was that 6 or 7 years ago now?
Right, mm-hmm. yes. And he's been around the state house. He's been on some high profile legislation known around there as a hard worker. And so within his own district, which is more of the eastern part of this area, he's probably going to do well. Whether Danny O'Connor then takes Franklin County kind of leaves a lot up in the air.
Hmm.
It could be a Delaware County versus Franklin County thing because, you know, a lot of that district in Delaware County, again, they know how to mobilize and it's a very strong Republican area.
But Jim Jordan came out for Melanie Lenihan, which was, you know, I saw the primary in that as very interesting for the Republicans because you had Pat T-Berry, the moderate, on TV for Balderson and Jim Jordan on TV for Melanie Lenihan. Jim Jordan being the leader of the, you know, almost founder of the Freedom Caucus in mm-hmm. Congress and mm-hmm. very high
co-founder,
profile
yeah.
But there's really,
conservative.
There's nowhere for those that part of the party to go.
Right.
They either vote for Balderson or they stay home.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
But are they excited to go out and vote and can they get that vote
out?
On a hot
August day mm-hmm. when they could be at the pool.
Right.
Right. It's going to go down in history.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We have Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press. We're talking politics this hour. the gender gap in the Quinnipiac poll showed men preferring DeWine and women preferring Cordray. Do we think that matters at all in this gubernatorial race or in any of the races?
Well, I would say that a lot has been made of the fact that the entire Republican ticket is white men.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly that could be an issue in the hashtag Me Too era. But at the same time, you know, the Democrats pushed several women out of the governor's race mm-hmm. In favor of Cordray, too. So,
but the entire ticket's, you know,
more diverse. Right.
Yeah, it's more diverse.
So he's got a female running mate. And
Kathleen
they have
Clyde running for Secretary
right,
of State.
Right.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of women running this year. There's a lot of enthusiasm for women candidates. I think there's a lot of voters that would like to vote for women candidates. So the fact that those women are on the ballot and they're on the Democratic side, you know, it's going to help boost their numbers some.
If you remember I'm forgetting his name, but the Alabama Senate race, Roy Moore.
Moore. Mm-hmm.
It was African-American voters and black women who really tipped the scales in favor of Doug Jones. If we do see that kind of outreach or that kind of voter outreach.
African-American women and African-American voters and white women. Did you say?
African-American women were the people who most voted for Jones.
Okay.
And then African-American men and women voted for Jones. And then, yes, and then women after that. But
yeah.
So it's just that outcome, the amount of people, the turnout really helped tip the scales. And if there is that kind of turnout in Ohio, then you're
that's
right.
That's a big
I think
if.
The, right. That's
you
a
know,
big if.
I yeah. was surprised that the primary didn't get – I mean, I wasn't expecting a miracle, but it was as if it was pre-2016.
Mm-hmm. Right, that it was just basically Same old, same old.
Same old, same old. Yeah.
Well, remember, though, I mean, the Democratic Party did not endorse in the primary.
They learned that
they did, and Chairman David Pepper did tell me, you know, we didn't remember that we did not mobilize. We were not showing off our forces here in the primary because we wanted them to fight that out. And now we will put forth the effort on the get out the vote.
And I think another thing that we're going to see is the question that we always ask ourselves is how much does public outrage around a social issue actually equal voting results?
Uh-huh.
So people seem to be so angry about guns. They want gun control. They want less power for the NRA. Are those people going to turn out in the masses to vote for somebody who is more for gun control? Hmm. That's kind of an iffy thing because it's Cordray as the nominee, so it's not as outright. But then we have the Me Too movement. We have everybody who, talking about the Me Too movement and Time's Up. Is that going to result in any sort of different outcome as far as elections go?
Because you're right, Ann. It didn't in the primary. Things like State Rep. Rick Perales, who had a rival in the Republican primary who had accused him of sexting and trying to choke her and whatever. It had no impact on him getting elected. You know, we didn't see any problems for Bill Seitz or Matt Huffman or the people who had been caught up.
Glad you brought up Bill Seitz. He's just got a break.
Well,
Republican from Cincinnati.
Yes, we got a copy of the investigative report into a kind of a weird little complaint against him. An anonymous House staffer had written a lengthy complaint that basically said when Bill Seitz of Cincinnati had spoken in remarks at this going away party for the chief of staff, he made some misguided remarks, I mean, offensive, and he had already apologized for them. But basically, he said things like, Cliff Height, who had been, who'd resigned over sexual harassment, his theme song should be Blowing in the Wind, and, you know, some other really kind of off-color things.
Yeah,
so he had already apologized, and this woman wrote a letter saying, it shouldn't stop there. Something else should happen. There's a climate in the State House of fear for women who want to apologize. She describes some really stunning things about encountering women crying in the halls, men requiring hugs of their women staffers and putting their bodies up against these women. And so they hired outside counsel to look at the complaint, and it happened to be Taft Stettinius, which is where Bill Seitz worked for 35 years or so. They had no conflicts in the legal world.
That was
world.
The outside counsel was
right.
The same firm that he worked with for 35 years.
Right. Hmm. And the conflict check that you do in law
seems
doesn't
so
have
advised.
To do with something like, do you know someone?
Yeah.
It has to do with, do you have any legal overlap and that kind of thing. So they didn't have any conflicts. They did the investigation, which was pretty cursory. They interviewed one man, one woman, and Seitz, and came to the conclusion basically that there were three things about it. One was that the remarks were made at a party, so they fell outside of the anti-harassment policy that applies.
Official duty type thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Two was that the woman wasn't at the party. She heard about it through a blog and not, wasn't in attendance. And then three was Seitz's explanation, which was essentially like he didn't intend it to be offensive. It was in this context of this roast. And so that was the conclusion. Whether there needs to be more done there, I don't know. One thing about us having to take our lawyers in to get this report was that I think, and I said this to Seitz when I interviewed him, you know, it's coming out now only because we fought for it, but why isn't there a process where everyone knows where to file a sexual harassment complaint, everyone knows where to find the follow-up material, mm-hmm. and that the investigative report is published once it's available, similar to the...
What did he say?
He actually had not seen the report either until our lawyers got a copy of it. So I think that
I guess he wasn't too worried.
Well, I mean, it's a double hit for him if you want to look at it from his point of view. And so, you know, maybe he advocates for that. I don't know. But it's a process that's, I've also written about it previously for Sunshine Week, that it's a bad process. You have to go all over the place. You don't know if the complaint has gone to the Legislative Inspector General, to the LSC, the Legislative Service Commission, or to one of the houses, whether it's been handled verbally. There's no consistency or anything on it. And so that's kind of what I came away with, is the Ohio Inspector General publishes reports of what he investigates and what the findings are and what the responses are. And I feel like we've come to that point in the states where we need to have that kind of accountability.
Is there any indication that there are other complaints along those lines, not necessarily against representative sites, but just in general out of the state house?
Well, his was one of seven this year that mm-hmm. came out because of Me Too, and because reporters pushed and got records and pushed again to get investigative findings and got tips. And, you know, these are the kind of things that are not clear unless reporters fight for it.
And that, and now we have also learned that you have to, like Julie said, keep fighting for it, keep asking it, asking to see if anything's happened, because the senator cites sexual harassment, then Representative Goodman, and then because of those two resignations,
Senator Height,
and then right. Representative Goodman,
right.
And then because of those two resignations, reporters asked, "Well, are there any other allegations? Are there any other complaints mm-hmm. out there?" And then we find out, oh, yeah, in the past 2 years, there have been four or five of them or something like that. Oh, so it's not transparent.
It is our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Andy Chow, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also with us, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch and Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press. We're talking politics this hour. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly Reporters Roundtable. We're talking about politics this hour, mostly. There's a new poll out from Quinnipiac. It says all sorts of things about what's going on, including that Governor Kasich is popular with Democrats. In fact, he's more popular with Democrats than he is with Republicans. I don't know if that's ever happened. Maybe Voinovich? No,
I don't think
it's ever happened.
I don't think it's ever happened.
Well, wow.
And it goes to whether
it has more to do with the Republicans than it does the Democrats, probably, in a way.
It does. Yeah. I mean, Kasich has been very outspoken against President Trump, which, you know, a lot of Democrats like that. Governor Kasich has also worked with Democratic Colorado Governor Hickenlooper on some health care issues, trying to come up with a bipartisan approach to that issue. Mm-hmm. So I think I guess it's surprising, but maybe when we think about it, it's not surprising.
He's also a lame duck governor who hasn't really done anything to offend Democrats. He hasn't really pushed out any policy.
He said he wouldn't go for right to work. He doesn't think it'll work.
He hasn't done anything in the past year to make them think otherwise. Anybody, I mean, it's just kind of a target-rich environment right now, where if you're out there and you're not pushing policy for anything and all you're doing is complaining about President Trump, I think it's easy to appeal to people.
And he also, you know, he did push Medicaid expansion through Ohio, you know, enacted that in Ohio, mm-hmm. which Democrats really supported. and Republicans really opposed. A lot of Republicans opposed. So it's kind of surprising, but not really.
It's so...
It's through the looking
glass. It's so easy right now. It's so easy right now. He goes on national television and every week, reporters and moderators, they use him to be the guy to go after President Trump, but nobody's really asking him the hard questions on television. He's not facing any sort of contradiction when he goes out. So it's very easy to build a public persona around that. It's totally fine. That's how we saw other people rise through the ranks in the past.
Right. And he's putting behind him by a year or two his most controversial stuff on abortion, mm-hmm. which is one of his vulnerable spots should he want to run for president, I think, with the national in winning a national election. He vetoed the most recent, most extreme proposal, which was the heartbeat bill. I think he mm-hmm. vetoed that, and then he also took it out of the budget subsequently. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he wants to be seen as extreme on that issue.
And he's promising to veto the Stand Your Ground law, which is a pro-gun piece of legislation, if that were to ever come to his desk. So he is taking these stances on certain policy issues that would, again, appeal to Democratic voters.
And he's doing this with some – he's stating out loud his philosophy related to this, which is that he doesn't believe everybody has to agree, but he thinks that it's the job of – leaders to come to the table and work that out. It happens to be convenient for him that Trump does not lead that way, and so he can compare and contrast mm-hmm. himself – even if he would run as a Republican against a sitting president. But he's building that for sure since 2016.
But doesn't that poll say he's got no future to run as a Republican for Senate, for president?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, the next question I had is, who cares if he could take Ohio? He's done that before. It's the other 49 states.
Right. And but I think... This is just anecdotally speaking, but I think he's more popular with Republicans outside of Ohio. Republicans in Ohio seem to have their own personal grudges and feeling like,
well, he didn't show up to the convention.
Exactly.
Or, you know,
the convention was exactly what I was going to say.
Well, his own lieutenant governor was distancing herself mm-hmm. from it.
Yeah.
But again, just anecdotally, when you talk to Republicans from other states—
They see him on.
They find out that you're from Ohio, and they say, "Oh, you've got that Governor John Kasich. You know, he's my kind of Republican. He's the kind of guy I want for." So, yeah,
he is building Republican.
Maybe exactly. He doesn't need Ohio, huh?
Mm-hmm. That yeah, exactly. Maybe it doesn't matter.
It might flip the script.
Amelia Sykes, she's a state rep from Akron. Spoke up this week about discrimination. She says she believes she's been seeing profiling at, it's unclear if it's actually the State House or the Reif Tower, the Reif Government Office Tower mm-hmm. Downtown. In any event, she's saying she's had her bag searched several times after presenting her State House ID, showing that she's an elected official and being told at one point, at least back in 2016, well, you look too young to be a lawmaker. She's complaining about it, and she wants a meeting with the State Highway Patrol about this. In the meantime, what do you guys make of this?
I mean, I have a State House ID. I've never had anybody look in my bag. I've never had anybody stop me. I just slide
in either building.
No, never, never.
I've never been searched.
No. Huh.
I mean, to get into the weeds, the Reif Building is going through a new security process, and so I carry a book bag with me. So I do get stopped even when I have a badge. I get stopped often. So especially at the Reif. Now at the State House, we have a badge that.
What can we say, Andy?
Right,
Andy. We're all clumped.
So, but at the State House again, all you need is a badge, and the representatives have a badge, and you just scan through. You don't get stopped as long as the badge works.
Right, and she actually had a meeting with the State Highway Patrol to talk to them about it. I think she's pretty concerned. I get the sense that there's a larger context here because we also saw in the last week or so some of the protesters kind of pushing forth to try to get into the state house and being turned away. There was an arrest, maybe two. And I feel like this is something that maybe is burbling down there as a issue this year as far as access. And
but when you're dressed professionally, like, you know, she and all the other lawmakers are when they're in the state house buildings, and you're walking in, as she described it, with a group of lawmakers,
white men,
and you're singled out.
We should point out that she's black.
Yep, that's right. I didn't.
Right. And she does look young. I will give her that. She's very fortunate. She does look young. But just imagine yourself in that situation where you're with a group of colleagues and you're the one that gets stopped and you're the one that gets searched.
And more than once.
And more than once.
Several times a couple years ago, and apparently it started up again.
Yeah, and you would think that the guards at the state house would have a picture directory of the House and Senate, at least.
After a while. And she's been around for a while.
She's not new. I mean, she's been around. I mean, there are 99, so there are a large number. It's not like the Senate, you know, where there's just 33. Well, she is in the House, right?
Yeah, she's in the House, yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of embarrassing.
I don't know if this should be added or not, but the security at the State House and at the Reif is a diverse group of people. It's not all white people. So I think that should be added too. There's a diverse group of people who are standing as security and state highway patrol troopers.
Keep our eyes on that. Kathy Kandisky, you have been writing about the middleman in
pharmacy middleman.
Pharmacy middleman, middle people, whatever you want to call them, for quite a while now. I mean, you've got another story out this week. Tell us what's going on right now.
The issue that we've been focusing on are these pharmacy benefit managers who manage pharmacy benefits for health insurers. And this story we had over the weekend was about the Medicaid program. We tried to look at what the issue is simply put. It's kind of complicated, but the issue is these pharmacy benefit managers are getting paid by the state Medicaid program far more than they're then going ahead and reimbursing to pharmacists to fill the prescriptions. So the question is, what are they doing with all that extra money? And so that's what we tried to get into. So we got records from 40 pharmacies. The reimbursements paid to pharmacies are not public. We got 40 pharmacies to give us their records so we could compare those to the data that the state Medicaid program then reports to the federal government. In those 40 instances, for 40 pharmacies for the year of 2017, we found the spread, the difference between what they were paid and what the state paid for those drugs, was $1.6 million. So if you take that out, there's about 2,000 pharmacies statewide.
Just for those 40,
right?
Was 1.
We had somebody speculate it would be in the tens of millions of dollars that spread. Of course, those are tax dollars, which is why we're focusing on the Medicaid program. But this also happens. You probably, you know, a lot of people I work with were surprised to hear that we at the Dispatch, our insurance company, we also had a pharmacy benefit manager. Our pharmacy benefit manager is Express Scripts, which you probably heard of, but may not have known what they do. In the state Medicaid program, CVS Caremark, which also owns the retail pharmacies, they have their own pharmacy benefit manager as well. They're the big player in the state Medicaid program. There's about three big pharmacy benefit managers in the country.
It's stunning. It's really good work.
It's stunning,
it
but
good work.
It's complicated and it's kind of hard. I mean, it's a challenge for us to kind of break it down and describe it so people can understand it. But the most important thing you need to know is you're paying more for drugs than pharmacists are being paid to deliver those drugs. So what's happening to, as a taxpayer, we should all care. What's happening to all that money that isn't going?
How are lawmakers responding to this? How are policymakers responding?
Well, there's a JMOC, a little known committee of the legislature, Joint Medicaid Oversight Committee. And they're very interested. And there's Republicans primarily on that committee that are interested in this, Democrats as well. They've asked the state to look into it. The state is expected to release a report in the next week or two where they're looking at reimbursement rates across the whole Medicaid program. So it should be a much broader examination than the one we were able to do. That should be coming out, and I think the legislators want to see what those results show, and I fully expect there's going to be some regulation or law or legislation on this regard.
It's interesting to me because, you know, some of these players are business interests here in the state of Ohio.
Right.
So.
Right.
And when the state is trying to find money anywhere it can to try to help addiction recovery, to try to help addiction prevention, in this world.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
that's what the lawmakers are pointing out. You know, Ohio is looking at imposing work requirements on people that get Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, you know, that's going to reduce costs because people are going to fall off the rolls. Well, maybe we wouldn't have to do things like that. And that may be a bad example because there's other reasons you have work requirements. But cuts in payments to providers, like hospital payments, are being cut right now because they needed to cut them to make budget. There's things that you might not be able to do. You might be able to provide more generous benefits in the program. You might be able to just save money and use it for something else. There's all kinds of reasons we should all care that we're maybe spending more than we have to on pharmacy benefits.
In tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. The annual pharmacy spend in Medicaid is about $3 billion, just to give you an idea how big it is.
Lawmakers are back at work this week?
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think so. Ryan Smith is the new House Speaker.
Yep.
And came through the process of
whatever you want to call it.
Whatever you want to call it.
Ugly, ugly.
I've got words. But he's coming back to the State House to try to get some stuff done. I think they only have sessions this week, and then they're going to.
I think they have one more next week.
They
one
took
more.
A week off after taking action on 28 bills.
Uh-huh.
What are we expecting them to do this week?
A lot more bills. There's a lot more committees, a lot more bills coming through. I think I was trying to nail down wondering if one of them was going to be on the floor, and I think Stand Your Ground might be on the floor this week. Again, that's
the one that the governor
has said that he would veto, yeah. Right? So that's the one where it would make it easier to use lethal force in a self-defense situation. I just did a story about how there's a whole other provision in the bill that would upend the way courts handle self-defense situations on the whole, not just for guns. It would put it on the process. It would put the burden of proof on the prosecution rather than the defense in a self-defense scenario. Ohio is the only state in the country that puts that burden of proof on the defense right at this point. So that's one of the bigger bills that could make it to the floor this week.
I think I haven't been covering it, but the payday lending bill, I think, is going to be up in the Senate.
Okay, that went through the House.
Yeah, it went through the House, and so now it's on the Senate side of things. So it'll be interesting to see how they handle it, because that chamber is not plagued with scandal as far as who's taking money from what. So it'll be interesting to see if they handle it a different way, if they might add amendments to the bill to what some see as weakening the bill.
There's also some interesting things they're not doing. They're not going to change the graduation requirements. They've had softened or relaxed high school graduation requirements this year.
Mm-hmm.
As they put new, tougher ones in place, there was some pushback. So people have been asking them to extend the softer requirements for another year or two, and it doesn't look like they're willing to do that. That fell off. There was another bill to kind of gut the Department of Education and give the governor more control, and they decided to kick that. That's off the table.
Right.
So there's some things that they're not doing that are as interesting.
But there were something like over 100 bills that got bottlenecked because of the delays.
7-week hiatus.
Right. And things like Ohio needs money for voting machines and other things released. And so they have a lot of work to do.
Well, we'll talk about it next week on our Weekly Reporter Roundtable. In the meantime, Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, good to see you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And Andy Chow, reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks to you as well.
Thanks, Ann.
Thanks, everybody else, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.